their way. Why the perfect murder?
Oh, aye. It can't be detected. That's what he said. It leaves no trace at all, just dissolves into the blood.
And what did your son say to you, Mrs. Marshall?
He said, I know Alice has tried to poison me.
He opened the door and found himself in the hands of two murderous brutes. Then he was dragged back into the parlor and this time murdered.
Murder Most Foul. Six forensic murder cases presented by Nick Ross. Case 3, The Perfect Murder.
Oh. That's better. I'm so tired.
Murder, by definition, is never perfect. And yet the history of the crime is littered with people who thought that they'd committed the perfect murder. Perhaps they'd conceal the dead by hiding the body so no one could prove that a death has ever taken place. But there is another way. Instead of the vanishing victim, what about the disappearance of the means of murder? The victim simply dies. Foul play is undetectable because the cause of death has dissolved without a trace. Late at night, on the 3rd of May, 1957, a doctor was called out to a small terraced house in Thornbury Crescent, Bradford. Elizabeth Barlow, a woman of about 30, wife of Kenneth Barlow, lay on her side in the bath, her arms bent as if she were asleep. She was dead. The doctor called Bradford CID, and soon Detective Sergeant Naylor was on the scene.
She's in the bath. I'm sorry, I've got to leave for another call.
Righto, Doctor.
But I'd say she drowned. It says she vomited earlier. She might have been overcome by weakness and slipped down till her head was underwater. Oh, but the pupils of her eyes were very widely dilated. I don't know why. It's just what you want to be called out for, eh?
Correct. And the husband?
He's through there. Oh, must be off.
Mr. Barlow?
Yes?
Detective Sergeant Naylor.
Hello?
I'm sorry, may I have a look at her?
Oh, of course. It's this way.
Oh, God. This is as you found her?
No, she was under the water. I tried to pull her out, but she was too heavy. So I pulled the plug out and I tried to give her artificial respiration. I'm a nurse, you see. I did everything I could, but she was dead.
And when did your wife get into the bath?
Well, I woke her at 7:30, like I said, but she said she wanted to stay where she was. Then she called out at about, it must have been about 9:20, and she'd been sick in bed. So I changed the bedclothes and then went to bed myself. Then, a bit later, she said she felt too warm, so she went to take a bath. Well, I didn't think too much of it. I dozed off, and when I woke again, I realised she hadn't come to bed. So I went to come and get her, and there she was.
I see, Mr. Barlow. Could I have a look in the bedroom?
Yes, of course.
Barlow's story seemed perfectly genuine, but for some reason Sergeant Naylor wasn't quite convinced. In the bedroom there were Mrs. Naylor's pyjamas, damp and sweaty to the touch, as was to be expected. But looking at the bed, it seemed that only one side had been slept in. And then back in the bathroom, where Elizabeth had been taking a hot and supposedly steamy bath, there was no condensation on the walls or on the window. What's more, there were no water splashes on the floor. Naylor called his chief constable, who decided not only to come to the scene himself, but also to contact the Harrogate people, the police laboratory at Harrogate. At 3:30 in the morning, after a long and difficult drive over dark roads, the men from Harrogate arrived. Chief Inspector Coffey, who was on duty that night, and Dr. David Price, a pathologist and forensic scientist of great experience. Dr. Price began by looking at the body, still lying in the bath.
Chief Constable, could you come in, please?
Yes?
Two things. First, the eyes. I don't think I've ever seen eyes quite like that. Those pupils are so wide, you can hardly see the iris at all. I'd say she was under the influence of some sort of drug.
Any idea what?
No, not at this stage. We'll have to get her back to the lab. The other thing is, Barlow says he tried artificial respiration. Is that right?
Yeah.
After he let out the water?
Yeah.
Well, have a look here at the elbows.
So?
You can't attempt artificial respiration without manhandling the body. And if you do that, those arms move, don't they? And the water escapes. You can't have pools of water like that trapped in the elbows.
I see what you mean.
Sir?
In the bathroom. When you move the body, measure the quantities of water, would you?
Right.
Sir, I found these in the kitchen.
Did you know?
They were in a pine pot, in the pantry, wrapped up in a handkerchief.
Mr. Barlow?
One of them's still wet, you see? Here.
Hello?
Mr. Barlow, could you tell me what these were doing in your kitchen?
Well, yes. Well, I'm a nurse. I often have syringes around the house.
And what have you been using them for?
I've had a carbuncle, been treating it with penicillin injections.
And have you been treating your wife as well?
No.
Have you injected your wife with anything?
No. No, nothing at all.
Thank you, Mr. Barlow.
At 5:40 in the morning, Dr. Price began his autopsy. And then, at a more respectable hour, he was joined by Dr. Alan Curry of the Home Office Forensic Laboratory. Surely anything these two couldn't find between them wasn't there.
You've been having fun, then?
Yes, thank you, Dr. Curry.
And what have you come up with?
Very little. The woman is hot. She's sweating. She takes a bath. Then suddenly she's overcome by a weakness. So something's given out, hasn't it? But as far as I can see, all the organs are sound. All normal. And I've given the intestines and spleen a bacterial examination, and there's no sign of infection whatever.
Well, then, the lady ought still to be alive, then, shouldn't she?
Yeah, precisely. There's also no injection marks on the skin. Ah, one thing I did find. She was pregnant, about 2 months. There again, it seems to have been perfectly normal. Gives no explanation for her suddenly deciding to faint and drown in the bath.
All right, we're going to have to look in rather more detail, aren't we? I suggest we test the entire digestive tract. We'll just carry on until we find whatever it was that killed her.
And so followed analysis after analysis. Several hundred chemical tests were carried out to reveal any traces of medicines or poisons, and biochemical checks to show up any blood disease or metabolic disturbances. But every test proved negative. The two hypodermic syringes and needles yielded tiny traces of procaine penicillin, but that only seemed to confirm that Barlow had injected himself, just as he'd described. Even so, Dr. Price was haunted by those dilated eyes. On the morning of the 8th of May, 1957, taking his magnifying glass and a strong light, the pathologist set out once again to examine the entire skin surface of the victim, this time in minute detail. The dead woman was heavily spotted with moles, freckles, and acne, but after 2 hours, Dr. Price was finally rewarded. Detective Chief Inspector Cheshire was now in charge of the case.
You've come up with something, then?
Yes, when at first you don't succeed. Two tiny marks close together on the left buttock. And again, two more tiny dots in a fold of skin on the right buttock.
So, Barlow was lying. He did inject her.
Ah, that's up to you, Detective Superintendent. All I can
say... And what was she injected with?
Now, that I don't know. The tests have shown nothing at all.
Yeah. So, Barlow could claim they were just, vitamins or something.
Yes, it might even be true.
Oh, you don't believe that any more than I do. He injected her with some specific poisonous substance. We've just got to find out what. So, we'll have him watched. And we'll find out if any medicines he could have got his hands on at St. Luke's have disappeared. And what's your next step, Doctor?
This is Professor Thompson, head of chemical pathology at Guy's. Dr. Price, pathologist and forensic scientist.
Hello.
Mr. Randall of the Boots Pure Drug Company in Nottingham.
How do you do?
Well, gentlemen, you all know the background to the case. Mm-hmm. The first question I think we have to deal with is, what drug or medicine could have produced in a woman in the early stages of pregnancy the symptoms that apparently preceded Mrs. Barlow's death? Mm.
To me, the symptoms suggest hypoglycemia. What about it?
I don't think so. Urine tests after the autopsy proved that Mrs. Barlow wasn't diabetic. Now, in one of the biochemical tests, I removed some mixed blood from the two chambers of the heart and examined the blood sugar content. I don't know quite what to make of it, but that sugar content was considerably higher than normal. 210 mils of blood sugar to each 100 mils of blood.
Hmm.
Whatever else that means, it would seem to indicate that hypoglycemia was definitely not the cause of death.
The scientists continued the deduction process of trying to discover just what had killed Mrs. Barlow. Insulin is the usual treatment for diabetes when blood sugar levels are too high. But since Mrs. Barlow was not a diabetic, what would have been the result of her being given a massive dose of insulin? Could it have resulted in a coma? Professor Thompson pointed out that if the level of sugar in the blood falls too low, the patient can indeed go into a coma, suffering from hypoglycemia, unless glucose is administered. But Dr. Price observed that Mrs. Barlow's blood contained very high blood sugar levels. Did this knock out the insulin theory altogether? Meanwhile, the police had been investigating Mr. Barlow's background, and they produced a startling report. Kenneth Barlow had been married before, and that first wife had died in 1956 at the age of 33. No real cause of death had ever been discovered. One after another, Barlow's former colleagues were now interviewed.
Yes, Doctor, I'll be along as soon as I can.
So, Matron, you were saying?
Well, yes, Mr. Barlow would have supervised the injection of insulin for diabetics. There's no reason why he shouldn't have. Here, just a minute. Look,
mm-hmm.
There are a number of entries by him for just that.
And was any definite check kept on the insulin that was used?
No, there's no need for that.
So if Barlow chose to take away some bottles of insulin for his own use, that wouldn't be detected?
No, I don't suppose anyone would notice.
Oh, I'll tell you what he said, if you like. But he's only having a bit of a laugh. He said, that insulin, you could use that to commit the perfect murder. Of course, I never thought anything of it.
And did he say why? Why the perfect murder?
Oh, aye. It can't be detected. That's what he said. It leaves no trace at all. Just dissolves into the blood.
And when was that?
Oh, let's think. I was a student nurse at the time.
Yes.
At East Riding General. 1954, it must have been. The others, the experienced ones, they'd always be telling you things because you didn't know anything, really. But this was different.
In what way?
Well, it wasn't just a warning. Don't do this or that'll happen. No, what he said was you could kill somebody with insulin because it can't be found in the body unless it's a very large dose. I mean, that's not just a warning, is it? Why would I need to know if it could be found or not?
It's a strange fact that murderers sometimes seem compelled to return and hover near the traces of their crime, like a moth encircling a candle in the dark. Some will come back needlessly to the scene of the event. Others will come as close as possible to telling other people what they've done or how they've done it, as though the secret's just too big to keep inside. Maybe Kenneth Barlow's obsession with the perfect murder predated his attempts to put his theory into practice. Maybe a jury would convict him on what he'd said and the injection marks discovered on his wife's body, but maybe not. How could murder be proven to have taken place? How could insulin be shown to be the method? And why had the blood sample shown a high sugar content rather than a low one, as you'd expect after an overdose of insulin? Dr. Curry from the Home Office and his colleagues scoured the literature of forensic science, toxicology and biochemistry. But it seemed that no one had ever committed murder with insulin. Or if they had, they'd never been discovered. And no toxicologist had been faced with the task of detecting the presence of insulin in human tissue. Dr. Curry, though, was nothing if not thorough.
And so it's a logical process of deduction, dear father.
Yes, Dr. Price.
Now in your third year...
I've found it.
Found what?
Hamilton, Patterson and Johnson, 1940. Experiments to determine blood sugar values in deceased persons.
And?
Well, according to them, the amount of sugar in mixed heart blood taken after death may bear no relation to the amount of sugar in the blood as a whole.
Let me see.
At the moment of death, or immediately before it, the liver mobilizes its last reserves of sugar,
But that only just has time to reach the right chamber of the heart before death ensues, which is where it stops because the blood stops circulating. And that's why the mixed blood sugar taken from Elizabeth Barlow's heart contains so much sugar. It's not evidence that she didn't die of hypoglycemia. It's evidence that she did.
Good. Good. So far, so good. So, we know she died of hypoglycemia. Now we have to prove that it was an injection of insulin that caused it. How do we do that when there's no test that can identify it? Miss Pruitt, what shall we do next?
I don't know, sir.
It's quite logical. We have to create a test and then administer it. But what test?
Listen, we believe that Mrs. Barlow was injected with insulin. Now, the insulin may not be detectable, but it may still be there. In which case, it would still act as insulin acts. We may not be able to identify the insulin, but we can identify its effects. So let's inject some insulin straight from the bottle into a control group, mice, say, and observe the consequences. Very precise consequences. Then we make extractions from Mrs. Barlow's tissue and inject them into the mice. If the results are precisely the same, then surely we've proved that it was insulin that was present in Mrs. Barlow where it had been injected at the time of her death.
The police laboratories weren't licensed to carry out trials on animals, so the experiments took place at the Biological Assay Division of the Boots Drug Company. Mice were divided at random into two groups, an experimental group which would be injected with samples from Mrs. Barlow's body, and a control group with which the results could be compared. First, the control group of mice were injected with insulin. They developed the familiar symptoms. Then the extract obtained from Mrs. Barlow's tissue was injected into the other mice, and sure enough, they displayed the same symptoms. The extracts from the left buttock, where Dr. Price had thought the injection marks to be most recent, had a far stronger effect than the extracts from the right. The results, taken together, were compelling. On the 26th of July, 1957, Kenneth Barlow was brought in for questioning, facing Detective Chief Superintendent Cheshire and Detective Inspector Lockley.
Look, I keep telling you, I have no idea.
But hypodermic syringe marks were found on your wife's body.
So you keep saying.
And you're the only person who can tell us how they got there.
I've told you, I don't know, I don't know, I don't know! I don't know! Oh, all right. I injected her.
With insulin?
No!
With what, then?
I gave her 6 injections over 2 weeks.
Injected her with what?
Ergometrine.
What's that?
My wife said she was pregnant. She didn't want to have it. She kept pleading with me and pleading with me. She said she'd put her head in the gas oven. I swear it. She'd do anything rather than have the baby.
Why?
I don't know. I could never... Well, she was frightened the birth might kill her, I think. I kept telling her, but it made no difference. She used to lie awake, crying and crying, pleading with me.
So, what is this, ergo...
Ergometrine. To try and... To make her abort the baby. I stole it. I stole 6 ampules of it from St. Luke's. I gave her the 6th injection, the last one, after dinner on the day she died.
So why didn't you tell us this before?
Well, it's against the law, isn't it? And I stole the ergometrine.
Mr. Barlow, from information supplied to me, I believe that insulin was injected into your wife.
Well, that would have killed her. No, I gave her ergometrine. Only a small quantity each time. I used less than an ampule each time and I threw the rest away. I'm not responsible for Elizabeth's death.
In December 1957, Mr. Justice Diplock presided at Leeds Assizes. Kenneth Barlow, charged with the murder of his wife, pleaded not guilty. The case for the prosecution was outlined at some length by no less than the Solicitor General, Sir Harry Hilton Foster.
She was dead, and the immediate cause of death was drowning in the bath. Barlow and his wife seemed an extremely happy and devoted couple. He was very greatly distressed when she died. You may come to the conclusion that he had determined she should not bear the child she was then carrying. But apart from that factor, there is no sort or kind of reason outwardly why he should have desired her death. And apart from what science has discovered since she died, there would be virtually nothing that would justify the accusation which it is now the duty of the Crown to submit, that he murdered his wife by injecting her body with insulin. From that, perhaps, you will realize that this is an unusual and interesting case.
From the start, Sir Harry made it clear that his case rested squarely on the scientific evidence, the pioneering work of the Harrogate team. And from the start, he savaged Kenneth Barlow's belated claim that he'd injected his wife with ergometrine. Ergometrine had been one of the many drugs for which his wife's body had been routinely checked very early in the investigation. None had been detected. The defence was conducted by Bernard Gillis, QC. He too recognised that the case would stand or fall on the reliability of the scientific evidence. It was the credibility of this evidence in particular, and perhaps of scientific evidence in general, that little by little he had to undermine.
Dr. Price, you saw Mrs. Barlow in the bath after her death.
That's correct. The dilated pupils, the vomit, the damp sweaty pyjamas drove me to the conclusion that death was not due to drowning. I have seen many cases of death from asphyxia, but never before seen one in which the pupils were so dilated. It was as extreme a condition as one could find.
Dr. Price, do you agree that some of your findings are consistent with causes other than insulin?
Some of them, yes.
And did you carry out your examinations based on a knowledge of the history of the case? Well, Dr. Price?
I worked purely as a scientist.
So, is it possible for you to say, of any analysis that has been done here, that insulin is proved to have been in her body? You cannot go as far as that, as a result of your examination.
Extracts produce the effects of insulin. And substances which affected insulin affected the extracts. There are no direct chemical tests for insulin that I know of. If I'd had the knowledge that I have now, I would have taken pieces from elsewhere in Mrs. Barlow's body.
One after another, the expert witnesses appeared for the prosecution, explaining the function of insulin, describing the purpose and results of this and that experiment. And one after another, their expertise was gently brought into question, as when Dr. Maurice Gerd of the Boots Drug Company was cross-examined by Mr. Gillis.
Mr. Gerd, in cases where there is an infirmity of the pancreas, large quantities of insulin are manufactured naturally in the body. Is that correct?
I'm not a medical man, but I think that is so.
Unless you are certain that the body you are testing is not, from an insulin-producing point of view, abnormal, your whole experiment may be ill-founded.
We attempted to get over that difficulty with controlled experiments on a number of tissues.
As for the enlightenment of the court, Mr. Gillis, could you explain precisely what you're driving at?
Certainly, my lord. My point is that the experiments could only be of limited assistance unless it could be proved that there were no other insulin-producing sources in Mrs. Barlow's body before or after her death.
Thank you, Mr. Gillis.
My lord. So, Dr. Gerd, doesn't it really come to this? That you would have preferred that the extracts you were experimenting on should have included not only tissues and extracts from the suspected areas of Mrs. Barlow, but also other tissue and extracts taken from other parts of the body.
I agree. That would have been more desirable.
You agree. Thank you, Dr. Gerd. No further questions?
A Dr. Hobson of St. Luke's in London was called. He put forward a new theory based on the fact that the body, in moments of excitement or fear, produces adrenaline. In these circumstances, large quantities of insulin can also be produced. To reply to Dr. Hobson's theory, Sir Harry Hilton Foster recalled Dr. Price, the Harrogate forensic scientist.
And therefore, Dr. Price, would you like to comment on Dr. Hobson's theories?
Certainly. I wonder, is Dr. Hobson aware that the small area around the injection marks contained 48 units of insulin? Or if I were to express myself with the utmost caution, of a substance that acted exactly like insulin. Has Dr. Hobson considered what this means? Insulin poured out by the pancreas and distributed over the entire body would have to be present in fantastic quantities in order to achieve the concentration our results showed. Has Dr. Hobson calculated how many units of insulin the pancreas must have manufactured for this purpose? If not, I can do the calculation for him. The pancreas must have produced no less than 15,000 units. Has Dr. Hobson considered that a normal daily requirement of insulin in a severe case of diabetes amounts between 15 and 20 units? And finally, can Dr. Hobson suggest any explanation for the fact that the insulin, assuming that it had been evenly distributed throughout the body, should have collected in such large quantities at the site of an injection mark on the left buttock, and in much smaller concentration at the site of the earlier injection mark? I wonder if Dr. Hobson has any answers for these questions.
The jury then retired to consider their verdict. Within a few minutes, they'd returned.
Guilty.
Kenneth Barlow, you have been found guilty by a jury of a cold, cruel, carefully premeditated and calculated murder, which, but for a high degree of detective ability, would never have been found out. The law prescribes one sentence for your crime, and that is imprisonment for life. Take him down.
I'm innocent. I didn't do it. I didn't murder her. I'm innocent.
Kenneth Barlow's motive for killing his wife never became clear. But thanks to the painstaking work of the Harrogate team, the method of murder did and could never again go undetected.
In The Perfect Murder, Philip Sully played Dr. David Price and Stephen Thorne played Detective Chief Inspector Cheshire. Other parts were played by David Sinclair, Mark Straker, David Lerner, Nicholas Murchie, Joanna Myers, Teresa Stretfield, Matthew Sim, and Peter Gunn. Murder Most Foul was written by Rib Davis and presented by Nick Ross. The producer was Fiona McLean.